Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, it's Fitz, and if you don't know who I am, here's a quick bio. I'm a veteran sports journalist who writes, does TV, radio, and is a longtime podcaster. Also, I have stage 4 prostate cancer, so during the initial stages of the COVID-19 outbreak, my doctors advised me to stay at home. But now, a little more than a year later, I'm fully vaccinated and I've rejoined society. But I'm still continuing this podcast when I'm calling the many friends, athletes, coaches, and colleagues who I've met throughout my 30 years in this industry. Plus, this year, I'm going to be calling some people and making new friends. Oh, and I'm hitting the record button. Welcome to my life and the Life of Fitz podcast. The history of Kansas State football is so rich with dynamic, memorable players that came to Kansas State to play for Bill Snyder. And early on, when Kansas State was still getting its recruiting feet under it, Jim Leavitt was tearing it up, recruiting players out of Florida to come to Kansas State. It was probably a hard sell, but there was so much talent in Florida. In fact, he went in and found this defensive end. He was a linebacker in high school and pretty good basketball player, but he didn't look anything like a defensive end. In fact, he was way too skinny to be a defensive end. It was kind of comical to even think of him as such. I remember the first time I met Darren Howard in the Big 8 room of the old Veneer Complex. He walked in, and that was the thought all of us had. How the heck is this guy a defensive end at this level of football? It was astonishing how good he was, how athletic he stayed, despite increasing his weight maybe 50, 60 pounds over the course of his career. It was incredible to watch Darren Howard play. He was, to me, the Michael Bishop of defensive ends for Kansas State. There's never been one like him, before or after at Kansas State. Just one of those pure pass rush guys who could also hold his own against the run. He played a significant role in those great Kansas State teams. 97, 98, his senior year was 99. And then he spent 10 years in the NFL. So now let's call Darren Howard in Tampa, Florida.
Hello.
Hey, Darren. How are you doing, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm good, brother. I'm good.
Are you?
I am. I'm fine.
I didn't know if it was too early for you.
This is.
It is. I'm usually up at the crack of dawn, so I got to check myself sometimes. I was going to text you 7:30, and I was like, no.
Yeah.
I'm not going to work with him.
I am not a morning person. I'm not at all a morning person, but I had an important duty this morning. I was charged with getting the dogs to the groomer. And
that is important.
I know. So I had to be up and around. So it's especially when that's who you work with all day is the dog. So if they start smelling, those are literally your coworkers. So you got to do something with them.
I'm used to stinky coworkers, man.
Well, catch me up on
coworkers stunk.
Catch me up on Darren Howard. What's going on? You're down in Tampa now. What all you got going on in your life?
Wife, kids. Got a late start on all that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Fully focused on football until after retirement. Met my wife 6 years ago. Now we have three kids. So, nice. You know, kind of just hit the speed button on that for then. So my kids are seven. How old are my kids? 7, 5, and 2.
Man, 7. So you were in your late 30s when you decided it's time for kids, right?
Well, yeah. Well, yeah, I don't know if I decided it. Somebody did.
Yeah, I get that. That'll mean you're an old man at high school graduations. That's okay, though. That's okay.
Oh, yeah.
You'll be
yeah,
the cool
I've,
old
I've
dad.
I've already envisioned that. Yeah, I'm trying to figure out. I'm getting my outfits together and everything. Because I got a shot.
Exactly. So what all you got going on in your career? I've noticed you do some audio stuff, and you're just kind of got your fingers in a lot of things, don't you?
Yeah. Master of none. Uh-huh. You know the saying.
Yep.
But right now I'm in my studio. We do a lot of voiceover work for movies and television. So right now I'm here every day, which wasn't always the case, but ever since COVID started, this is like this sanctuary where I can come and be safe because we only have maybe 5 to 10 people coming out of the building a week. So yeah, this is where I spend most of my time. I'm into real estate. My wife opened the shop, so that ran me ragged for about a year and a half trying to get that started. Retail is a monster.
Man. Oh, man.
And we were going to open in March of last year, so we were getting all revved up. We got the renovations done, and COVID came and squashed all our plans. So we had to pivot, get our online store rocking, and just do it a different way. So. But, you know, it's still up and running and hoping for, you know, things to open up a little faster pretty soon here and, you know, get ahead of things.
Yeah, man, that you talk about bad timing for you getting ready to open a physical location and boom, the whole world changed.
Yeah.
What'd you learn about yourself during that process and being able to pivot like that?
I don't know. I always considered myself flexible. So, you know, anytime things come along that I can manage them and I can figure out what to do next. I'm very like procedural in things. But I was able to navigate along with somebody else in doing that.
Yeah.
You know, most of my life is just me, internal, figured out. But now, you know, we're in this thing together. We have to figure out together. She has her visions. I don't really have visions for her shop. I'm just in the back end, in the skeleton, just trying to make things work, make the numbers work, make the inventory work, get the online store operational and effective. So, you know, just working hand in hand with her, I mean, it's been a learning process. The whole marriage thing, not even just COVID, just being married is totally different, you know?
Mm-hmm. I know. It's
I know you know.
I'm at 31 years, so it's kind of like walking through a minefield every day, and you hope to get to the other side, and somehow you keep doing it. It's awesome, but it's good
every day.
It's good. I'm fascinated by how you got into audio production. How'd you end up in that field? It's a really cool field.
Well, I probably started with one of my little league coaches. He was a big audio head. Like he just, every car he had the loudest speakers in the city. Right. So it started there and he took me to his friend's house that was a DJ and he had all this equipment. And I was like, oh, that's pretty cool. What are you guys doing? So, you know, I take that stuff back, not the equipment, but that idea back home. And we had like one of those multi audio stereo device that had like an 8-track and a record player and the radio, AM, FM radio and all that, all in one piece. And I started trying to DJ with that thing, you know, just going inside of it, rewiring it and just tearing it up. So finally my coach gave me a mixer. That was my first real piece. And I had that mixer all the way through college, actually. And I got to college. I started DJing, doing a lot of the DJing parties, doing the parties at the union and house parties. Started building up my equipment and then got the bug to actually make the music that I was playing. So I got some production music, started making beats and guys would come over to the house and I built a whole isolation booth in one of our houses. Guys would come over. We'd be there 4 or 5 hours till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning making songs. So it just kind of, it started there and then got to New Orleans, built another studio, got to Philly, had one in my house, got to Tampa, bought a building that was already a studio and ended up taking over the business. And now I have, you know, I don't know how much money worth of spending in here. But yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's something that, you know, I caught a bug with early, and you know, just trying to keep it going. You know, it's something I enjoy doing. Real estate pays the bills. This doesn't really, you know, we honestly, like, we have two employees here, and they've been able to keep them afloat. But you know, as technology increases, the need for physical studio for people, especially now in COVID, like, everybody's at home. You know, you can record people through Source Connect or Session Link Pro or even Zoom sometimes, and they don't have to even come to the building. So the technology is getting more affordable, so our rates go down, kind of that trade-off kind of thing. Yep. So, you know, it is what it is. You know, we're just trying to navigate and pivot once again into other areas that we can help people with their social media accounts and their logos and graphics and web design, and kind of expanding the portfolio of our offering.
First of all, how did I never know about DJ Darren Howard during your football time?
Because he didn't exist. His name was DJ PJ. First of all, because I wore pajamas to my my gig.
That's freaking awesome. That's freaking awesome. Not only is it a kind of a gimmick, but man, you're comfortable as hell too. That's amazing. That's amazing. Not only is it kind of a gimmick, but you are comfortable as hell too. It's nice. Yeah.
Yeah, very comfortable. Like, I can go do my gig and then come back home and get straight into bed. I might brush my teeth. I might not. I mean, I was 20 years old. I mean, exactly. I don't know what I was doing.
Did Bill Snyder know about DJ PJ?
I think he did. I think, yeah, he had to, because we did I forget the show that used to feature the players. I don't know if they still do it, but it was me, Aaron Lockett, mm-hmm. and somebody else. They did a little piece, and they came to the studio, and Aaron was in the booth. So it was a little thing going on there. And every once in a while on the movie nights before the game, he would let me bring the equipment in and I would play beats and people would rap, and instead of watching movies or play video games, whatever we did. So he had to know, but I don't think he was really concerned with it.
You never knew with Coach. I mean,
no.
That could be okay. And then you could wear an earring into the building and all hell breaks loose.
Yeah. You will never see you again.
Do you think he has still the collection of earrings and stuff somewhere? He took so many off of players, it's unbelievable.
I have no idea, man. You know, I don't know. Maybe he melted it down, and now it's just a gold bar. There's a paperweight on his desk. I don't know. Oh. We all have these, like, grand ideas of what he does and stuff. What he says into his recordable, his vocal recorder. You know, when he's on the sideline,
yep,
at practice.
Yep.
Just wanted to get a hold of one of those pictures and what's going on.
Well, you know, my guy D. Scott Fritchin is co-authoring Bill's autobiography that comes out this fall.
I thought it was already out.
No, it's on pre-sale, but it comes out in November, like before Thanksgiving. And he had access to Coach's personal diary for this. So, wow. So Coach would read his diary to Scott and they'd go through it and talk about it. I'm like, whoa. Yeah, what was going through his head?
Yeah. I have to read it.
Yeah, it's going to be really good. And it's kind of funny. It was supposed to be like 260 pages, but I know D. Scott, and it ended up being 400. So it's going to be an investment of time to get into it, but I'm looking forward to it. So many topics right now. Let's talk about this kind of alteration in society. How's older Darren Howard handling all of these changes that they come so fast? I mean, and particularly the pandemic set it off. You're right. I mean, we had an office, we had a studio, we had a great setup, and in the pandemic we lost our lease and like you said, pivot, build a home studio, and now I'm sitting in my basement with a soundproofed room and a soundboard, and I got four mics for podcasting. It's amazing how adept we all ended up being needing to adjust on the fly to the pandemic, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, while some of us were lucky to be able to do so, like a lot of people weren't.
Yeah.
You know, it's just not a possibility for some people to move their jobs to home. And they just have to, like the essential workers, they still have to go in. And, you know, like hats off to all the nurses and doctors that were going through that. You know, like there's no pivoting there.
Well, it was
just nose to the, nose to the ground and keep grinding, you know? So, I mean, I have a friend that has an IT business, and he had a big lease on his big building, had, over 100 employees, and they had already built software to work from home, but they never ran it. And he was telling me all he had to do was push a button, he sent everybody home, and they never missed a beat. Like, that's what you really want to be able to do in a situation like that. But, you know, a lot of people weren't able to do that. So just depending on where you were, but pandemics have been rough, man. It's, you know, for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seemed like it went by fast, but a lot of people still hurting and feeling the effects of it. So, you know, it's just rough, man. It's something that I hope we don't have to live through again in this lifetime.
No, I'm with you. A lot of people work their entire lives for stuff that they lost in the course of a year. And it's been awful. And a lot of people that just need to work couldn't work at all. So it's just been, been something else. Let's change directions here and talk about how Darren Howard, Florida high school football player, ended up at Kansas State University. Who was your recruit? Was Jim Levitt the guy that recruited you back then?
It was Jim Levitt.
Yeah.
Yes. And he was a madman.
Oh, he still is.
I took almost all of my, I took four official visits. And I went on an unofficial visit to South Carolina. And then I went back on an official visit with a high school rival of mine, Sean King. He played quarterback at the time, played with the Bucks for a while. He ended up going to UNO in New Orleans. Tulane. But we committed to South Carolina together, and we were on the same plane going, same plane coming back. Had it all planned out, had it all figured out. And the guy that was recruiting me left. So you know how the recruiting game goes. Like when you have a coach that recruits you, he's watched all the tape, he's into you. And then another coach that hasn't seen your tape, and he has his own set of guys. He likes that guy. So the guy that took over our region wasn't a big fan. And that's when Jim Levitt came in, and he wanted me to come to Kansas State and take a look. And I called South Carolina, the coach, and I was like, you know, I'm going to take this last visit before I make it official. And I didn't think anything. I just thought it was going to be another visit and I'd come back. But he said, well, don't be surprised if there's no scholarship when you come back. So that let me know what that was going to be. You know, that kind of turned me off from it. Even the two visits I went to were great. I loved the coach, loved the facilities, environment. It was closer to home, even though it wasn't in Florida. But I just don't like, you know, I don't like mess. You know, that seemed like it's going to be a mess, you know?
Right.
Just from that one comment. So I went to Kansas State, still open, you know, not thinking I'm not going to go to South Carolina, but that kind of, you know, turned my stomach a little bit. So I go to Kansas State, I go to Kansas City, and I land. I have no idea about the geography of Kansas, first of all. But when I land, two guys meet me there. They both have on black leather jackets.
What?
I don't know. I don't know why. But they have on black. It's cold, but, you know, it's black leather jackets. Okay, well, let's go. They just said, Darren Howard. They said, yes, okay, follow me. All right, I'll follow them. And we walk through the airport. I'm thinking we're going to outside to a car. And we walk, like, literally down the hall and then back onto the tarmac. and we walk into this little plane. So my recruiting trip was one of my first flights ever in life.
Mm-hmm.
And then this plane was big enough for them two in the front and me in the back. That was it.
Oh my
so
God.
I was already definitely afraid of flying on big planes. So we got on that plane, and that plane, it was windy, and that plane was all over the place. And finally get there. I think I'm sweating by that time. We land in Manhattan at the airport, and Kendall Jacob is my recruit.
Nice.
He was from Texas. I met everybody, saw the facility. The guys were great. We went out twice to the same spot. Back then, I haven't been back to Manhattan in a while, but back then, Aggieville wasn't that big, as big as it is now.
Yeah.
There were no options. We went to the same place twice. So, okay, I got it. This is a small town. This is what we do. Okay. So it was fine, and I was on my way back. And then, you know, once I got home, back to St. Petersburg, just started weighing my options, started looking at the rosters, trying to figure out who else they were recruiting, because my thing was I wanted to play as soon as possible. So it really came down to the roster. Kansas State had been to some bowl games where they were winning some games. And just the overall atmosphere of the two cities. So pretty much the opportunity to play early weighed heavily more than anything else. And at the time, I think we had Dirk Oaks, who was a senior. And Nile Wyron was a junior on the other side. So I redshirted, and then that next year I got some playing time as a freshman. So, I mean, that was the whole goal. And people from Florida thought I was crazy to go to Kansas. They thought I had lost my mind.
They might have been right.
From little league coaches, high school coaches, friends, family. Like, what? My mom didn't even think I was going. She just thought I was going to have fun. And I came back. I told her I was going. And she was like, she didn't believe me until she dropped me off.
And how much did Darren Howard weigh at that time?
Oh my God.
220.
I didn't play football to go to college until right before my senior year. So I started gaining, like, purposely lifting weights and trying to gain weight at that time. And I got to 220 during football season, my senior year, and then basketball season was right after that. So I was back to like 195 by the end of that. So I probably walked on the campus maybe 205, maybe. Less than 210, I know that for a fact.
I remember the first time I saw you, I'm like, hold on, this guy's a defensive end? What? I mean, it was amazing how you transformed your body. When did you really start to fill out and become... I mean, you talked about playing as a redshirt freshman. You obviously put on some mass pretty quickly.
Too quickly, if you ask me. Like, between Coach Cole, the creatine, and the supplements and the fat sacks that they gave us at night, like, you ate dinner, then you go to the study hall, and then you send you home with a fat sack with just a brown bag of junk food, which you would eat every night. Ice cream sandwiches, all the whole shebang. And, probably by following that season, before spring ball, I was 260.
Man.
So I went from 205 to 260 within the span of a year. And couldn't move. I was slow. And I lost it all. I decided to lose all the weight. So I lost all that weight, and I got down to like 230. And then every year I gained like 5-10 pounds. I ended up around 245, 250 by the time I graduated. But yeah, they packed them on quick. But it didn't help me. It didn't help me at all, so.
I never realized when I was in college I was training like a football player. I ate the same kind of stuff, but I too put on 50 pounds my freshman year, but
good job.
I never shook it. I just kept adding to it. It was a good collection. So I just kept putting it on. That's incredible. What'd you end up playing at when you were in the NFL? What kind of weight were you carrying at that level?
So New Orleans, when I got to New Orleans, we had three D tackles called the Heavy Lunch Bunch. It was Norman Hands, Grady Jackson, and Martin Chase. Martin Chase was from Oklahoma. And Martin Chase was the smallest guy. He was 340.
Oh, my goodness.
Norman Hand was like 360, and Grady had to be like 360. The defensive ends that were there at the time were 275, 280 apiece. So, you know, I go there. I'm 265. I mean, the draft people are telling me that I'm too light. I was too skinny. So when I left Kansas State around 250, 255, I went on another eating bench, just trying to get heavy for the scale that the scouting combine, and still only got up to 260. But got to New Orleans, everybody's huge. So I played probably my first year around 265. I got as heavy as 285 towards the end of my run in New Orleans. And by the time when I got to Philly, it was the opposite. Everybody was small. Everybody was small and fast. So our D tackles were barely 300 pounds. My biggest guy was barely 300 pounds in that line. So my first year, I was still around 270. And then after that, I was 245. I was back to college weight, 245, 250 max for the remainder of the time.
It's kind of amazing how just within your career, the perceptions of what a D end should be in the NFL changed so much. And go from this big run stopper to the back to your dynamic pass rushing styles. It's incredible.
Yeah, it caught me off guard too. Like I just thought, you know, you just get as big as you can, and as long as you can still pass rush a bit, you're good. But you know, Philadelphia, they wanted them small and fast. Small and fast was the thing there. So again, pivot, and fit into the mold.
Yep. Let's roll it back to Kansas State and Nile Wyron. Was he in any way a role model? And if so, how did that screw you up for life?
absolutely. Nile was an absolute animal. Yeah. But yeah, I tell you this, like I was a blue chip linebacker. Every school I visited and every school that recruited me wanted me as a linebacker. Kansas State and Coach Levin was the only school that wanted me to play defensive end. So coming into Kansas State was like a whole complete change of position to come here also. So when I got there, I didn't really know pass rush because I didn't pass rush. You know, mm-hmm. I was quick. I was on the quick side. And I had good leverage, but I didn't know hand moves, how to move your hips, how to flip your feet out, all that stuff. And I got that through a combination of drills, and I got that through Nile. I patterned my pass rush off of a combination of Nile and Andrew Timmons. Hmm. And Andrew Timmons, he's down here. I talk to him every couple months. He lives around here, and I tell him all the time, like, a lot of my pass rushing game is modeled off of what I saw you do. And he was a guy that got hurt a lot. And I thought he was super talented, but he couldn't stay healthy, could not stay healthy. But, yeah, between now showed me my first technique. He took me to the goalpost and taught me how to hit the bag and flip your hips out. And, I mean, to the day I stopped playing football, I was doing that drill. So, you know, my 10th year in Philly, after practice, I was on the goalpost on the pad doing the same move. So, yeah, but, you know, off the field, you can't follow him. You can't. You got to separate him. I hung out with him as a freshman. But, no, as a wrestler freshman. And just that whole, like, 95 and 96 defense, those 2 years where I just got there, redshirted one, and then redshirted freshman my next year and got some playing time, that defense was – like, those are the intimidating guys.
I know.
All of them, across the board. I mean, you go from Mario Smith to Deshaun Fogle with the biggest shoulder pads in human history. You got Purcell Gaskins, a linebacker that won the high jump championship in the Big 12, right?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Or the Big 8 was the Big 8.
Yeah, Big 8 back then.
David Damon. He had Andrew Timmons. He had Dirk Oaks. He's like, 6'7"? Lurch. He's just this big old massive guy. And, those guys would just take your lunch, literally, on a daily. So, we were good. Our defense was good, but just coming in as a freshman and seeing those guys, I was telling my guys here at the studio the other day about when I met Brian Goosby, when we were in the same class. I'm thinking he's an offensive lineman. He tells me he's a running back. I'm like, there's no way you're a running back. So we go to practice and we're doing middle drill. And I guess this is their, they moved Brian to fullback, I guess. He was playing running back in high school, now he's a fullback. And we're doing middle drill, no DBs, no wide receivers. The ball's coming in between the tackles somewhere. And they had to run ISO play 7, 8, 9, 10 times in a row. But he had to go head up with PG and Deshaun Fuller and David Damon over and over and over again. I think they were trying to break him or just see what he was made of. And he didn't back down, but the level of contact and noise that those collisions were making, and he was coming back with, blood trickling out his nose, and, the linebackers were going crazy after every play. I don't know if I'm supposed to be here. I don't know if I'm made for this. Is this what college football is? Is this it? Those kind of interactions and those kind of things you see when you're a freshman, you're just getting there and you're just coming from high school and you're 18 years old and just the whole new experience in a new city and a new state, new people. It was a lot. It was a lot, man. But, those guys put their arms around you too, also at the same time. They bring you along because it was the mob mentality, because you have to step up, if somebody goes down or when it's, 2 or 3 years from now when you're the guy. So
they're amazing times. It's absolutely amazing for me as a guy from the outside to look back and realize I witnessed the beginnings of K-State football and what it, kind of became, but you're in the middle of it. Do you ever look back and think, those were incredible times?
It was. When I decided to go there and I started doing my research on Kansas State, because I've never heard of the school. I was never a guy or a kid that watched a lot of college football. So it was only a handful of teams that I really knew about. So, after doing the research and going back and checking out some of the bowl games and knowing the history of Kansas State, if you can call it a history, to where they were now, I saw it as an opportunity. I saw it as an opportunity to go somewhere and build something, or help build something, because it was already getting started. And when I got there, I was like, we're going to be good. There was not a year where you would go into practice or you're going to training camp or you had those cat days where you have 4 practices in one day and walked out thinking we're only going to win 5-6. There was none of that. I knew we were going to be good. I knew we were going to blow a lot of teams out every single year, every single game. So it was great, man. We had fun, man. We were together. And everything, never any drama between players that I remember was really consequential. But it was a great time, man. We were winning a lot of games. We were blowing out. Willie the Wildcat was swole from doing push-ups, and the crowd was jumping and they followed us everywhere. It was great. From a college experience, what else could you? What else could you want other than a national championship?
Yeah, the last edition of this podcast, I talked to Matt Miller, and it just really got me thinking about that '95 Holiday Bowl and how important that was to the program. But I remember being in San Diego, and there's 25,000 K-State fans in San Diego, and people in San Diego are like, what the hell is going on here? It was a really cool time. A number of people that were traveling everywhere.
Yeah, that was good. That was big, too, because we automatically knew wherever we went, we were going to be the home team. No matter what bowl game or where it was, we were going to be the home team. We could play a team in California, in a bowl in California, and still have more fans there at that time. So, yeah, it was great, man. I mean, the fan support was awesome.
Hey, it's Fitz. Let's hit the pause button right here and take a little break.
Rise and shine, football fans. This is Susanna Fuller from Morning Footy, a podcast part of the CBS Sports Galazzo Network covering the breadth of the global game. Join me, Nico Cantor, Charlie Davies, Alexis Guerreros, and guests every morning for the perfect blend of news, analysis, conversation, and exclusive interviews. If you love soccer, then look no further. We've got you covered for Europe's top five leagues, the W Gold Cup, the Champions League knockout stage, CONCACAF Nations League, NWSL, MLS, transfer news, and much more. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere podcasts are found. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Planet Premier League podcast. Each week, Cesc Fabregas, Nader Manua and myself talk all things Premier League.
As a player, you don't have time to talk. No. You don't have time to make a plan. You just need to deal with wave after wave after wave.
We watched Coach Carter and he said, afterwards, the game's just about doing this for your teammates. And I remember looking around halfway through the film and half the squad was asleep.
Planet Premier League. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
So your last season was 99, correct? So
correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So those 97 and 98 teams, how good were you guys? I mean, it just looking back on 98, I don't even think there's a question in my mind that that's the best K-State team in school history. But what was it like to be on the inside of that group?
I don't think I've ever been a part of anything where you knew what the outcome was going to be. Like you were so sure and so certain based on, you know, the work you put in, based on the guys around you, based on your coach, based on the availability of all the amenities that you need. We knew the confidence was there that we knew we were going to put up big numbers and we were going to hit a lot of people and win games. You know, I mean, that even as a pro, you know, New Orleans in 6 years and Philly in four, I don't remember but maybe a handful of games that I knew walking in that we were going to win. That was every week at Kent State. Every week. No matter who we were playing. Even when we played Nebraska, I was like, we're too good. We are too good. We're going to win. So, that's something that I haven't experienced since. So.
No, those were amazing teams because you just didn't win. You just, the game would get away so quickly. Sometimes it was completely non-competitive by the second half. It was amazing. Absolutely amazing. That 98 team, everyone, you know, and some rightfully so, talks about Michael Bishop and that offense. But dude, that defense, I mean, that team was really about defense, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I'm the biggest fan of Michael Bishop.
Mm-hmm.
Like, from the day he walked in, the first time I met him, I think I told him this story. And everybody knew that Mike was one of the toughest guys on the team. And so I was staying in those apartments right across, that used to be right across from the stadium. I don't know if they're still there. I mean, it's been so long, they probably fell down. But lived in those apartments, and we were at a house party, like a couple doors down from mine. And the first time I met Mike, I didn't even talk to him. I didn't really know who he was. So this is when he had just got there. That's another guy. And he's standing in the doorway of the house party talking to a girl. And he kind of leaning, he got it, you know, being cool, got his hand. He's leaning on the doorway, right? So I walk in. Somebody tells me, hey, close the door. I say, all right. So I turn around. I close. Oh, and I was leaving. I'm sorry. I was leaving. I was coming out. And they said, close the door behind you. So I close the door behind me. Mike's still in the doorway talking to the girl. Excuse me. And he taps me on my shoulder. And he said, "Hey, open that door." I was like, "No, they just told me to close the door. Why do I open it? Just open the door." All right. So I open the door, and he pulls his hand out of the hinge part of the door. Three fingers deep.
Oh, my God.
And just calmly tapped me on my shoulder and asked me to open the door. Instead of him opening the door himself, which he could have, or just an hour or something, "Hey, open the door for me." Like, oh. So I just walked away. I still didn't know who he was. And when I got to practice probably the next day or the next 2 days and saw he was our quarterback, I was like, all right, so that's that's who we usually want to be. He's going to be one of those tough guys that that get things done. So that's my Michael Bishop story. But going on
that's
to the defense,
story.
Like, but going on to the defense, I mean, we were loaded. We were loaded at every position. You can cover, you can hit, you can pass rush. We had a defensive tackle that played offensive tackle the next year and went to the draft, went in the NFL draft, and Damian McIntosh.
Yeah, that was incredible.
We were deep at defensive end. We were deep at linebacker. Some of the great linebackers that K-State had after that were, you know, freshmen and sophomores that didn't get any playing time. They were just watching and waiting their time. But, you know, between Jeff Kelly and Mark Seminole, Lieber, Monty Beisel was coming in behind me. I think that 98 season, a lot of our D-tackles got hurt. In the second half of the season, I played D-tackle exclusively. Well, Monty got a lot of time. Along with Chris Johnson, he got a lot of time that year, too. And, you know, Deshaun Carter at corner, Lamar Jackson at, I mean, every position was filled, you know. Skill-wise, so I thought I had never been a part of anything as loaded, as graded. I mean, I won a state title in high school in basketball, but we weren't that good. Mm-hmm. Like, we had to fight and scratch, you know? But, you know, if something got past the D-line, we knew the linebackers had it. If somebody got past the linebackers, we knew the safeties had it, you know? So that's just how we roll, man.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's great to be part of.
So you get drafted in the second round, correct?
Right.
You go off to training camp, and I've heard ex-players say that what they went through with Coach Snyder so completely prepared them for the NFL that they approached those early days of the NFL training camp totally different than maybe someone from another program. Was that your experience, that you had been through such a – I don't want to say brutal, but rugged preparation, that you were just ready for the next level?
You can say brutal. You said it and not saying it. It's hilarious. But, we practice hard, long hours. So, yeah, anything that you go through after that. And it depends on the franchise you went to. Like, we had tough training camps in New Orleans, mostly because it was 117 degrees in the swamp. Mm-hmm. But, there's a difference there, too, because if I got drafted down with the Philly, my experience would have been a lot different, you know, because when I got to Philly, our training camp was, I don't want to say it was, well, see, I'm pulling on you now. I don't want to say it was soft, but it wasn't as intense as it was in New Orleans. You know, we got out there, we did our work, and it was quick. You know, hour and a half, hour 40, and then we'll go back in, and then we'll go back out another hour 40. In New Orleans, we were out there 2.5 hours each. So it's just depending on the team you go to also. I will say New Orleans training camp was much easier than Kansas State training camps, but not as drastic if I went from Kansas State to like a team like Philadelphia.
I can't even imagine trying to tell a team, aside from the fact you can't do it now at NCAA football, we're going to have 4 days. I mean, there'd be a riot if you tried to do that nowadays.
Yeah, it would be a whole march.
I can't imagine, man. How do you do 4 practices in a day and get up the next morning and still be a functioning human being? It just had to be unbelievable.
I can't answer that question. We just did it. we just did it, man. I mean, that's what we were supposed to do. That's what we were told to do. And that's what we did.
Amazing.
I mean, and then the payoff is you blow teams out 66-7. You know, so what? I mean, what are you going to say?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like, you know, Nick Saban is notorious for having, you know, tough practices and tough camps, right? He wins a national championship every third year. He's always in the playoffs, you know. He goes to Miami and don't win any games. It's not the same, right?
Yeah.
You can't expect all that and then not have the result because the players are not going to go for it, you know. But, you know, Coach Nada had the recipe. He had the recipe. It was working. When we tasted it, it was good. And we wanted some more. So if you want some more, we got four practices today. We're going to have watermelon in the middle and a Coke. And we're going to go back out there and do two more. And we'll see you guys tomorrow.
Man.
That's what we do.
End of 98, you had the upheaval in the program. And Coach Stoops is gone by that point. But you had so many coaches leave. And 99 was just a kind of a weird season. It had to be looking around the locker room. You lost so many great players and so many different coaches were around. But the program kept going, didn't it? Just kept plugging away. It was incredible what Coach Snyder got rolling.
It is. It really is. I mean, that just shows you where the meat of the program is. The meat of the program didn't go anywhere. You know?
Yeah.
That's Coach Snyder. Yeah. And that's the principles that he laid down and the routines that he set in place and the people that he put in place and the way he manages those people, you know. I always said, as a head coach, you are less of a coach and more of a manager of men.
Hmm.
Like, your days of X and O-ing, the hours that you spend on that drastically decrease. But on the college campus, you got, 100, 120 guys that you got to manage on top of 20 coaches and assistant coaches. And you got to make sure everybody's doing their job and everybody that you got to delegate, you know, so you're managing this vehicle more than you are coaching. You know, that's the way it was when I got to, Philly. And DeReed, great manager of men. Great coach also, knew X's and O's, but knew how to handle everybody, knew who to put in certain positions, knew who to apply to this specific problem, you know, knew how to delegate. So I think when you have that, you can unplug different pieces and still keep rolling. As long as you're managing the vehicle, managing the organization and keeping everything intact and keep the gears oiled and everything that you got to do when you're overseeing things. So, for that, I think he was doing a great job at, and things didn't really fall apart until that manager of men left and stayed. And then we had somebody else come in and try to be a coach. Didn't work out.
Interesting. You played 10 years in the league, right?
Right.
How did your body hold up through that process?
During or like now?
Both. I mean, now you probably feel like you're an old man, but during the whole process.
My first 5 years in the league, I was pretty beat up. Had surgery almost every off season. Couldn't catch a break. And then by the time I got to Philly, nothing. So I made it through those first 5-6 years. I mean, it's rough, but at that time you're young, right? So you're young, you bounce back pretty good. If you don't have anything major, like you just move on. At that time they're giving you, you know, pills or whatever. So whatever you did have that was hurting, didn't hurt, particularly during the game. So, it's a trade-off. Like you're there doing what you've always wanted to do, what you dreamed of. And it's, do you want to do that and hurt a little bit, or do you want to go home? That's really what it boils down to, you know? So you put up with as much as you are willing to put up with? How important is to you is it? You know, for me, it was pretty important because it's something that I vocally and mentally put into the universe to do. You know, as soon as the idea popped in my head, that was it. You know, so, you know, it was going to take a lot, like a lot to keep me from being on the field and trying to produce best I can, no matter what was going on. But, you know, after a certain point, a certain length of time, that importance starts to decrease, mm-hmm. you know, first couple of years, nothing else matters with it. Year 6, 7, 8, there's a slope, at least for me. I can't speak for everybody, obviously, but you know, there's, if, you know, you deal with certain situations where it's more about the politics of the game, or, you know, it's more about contracts, it's more about business, right? And, you know, at that time, like, teams are starting to look for a replacement also. So it's a different stage. You got to start figuring out what you're going to do after. And mm-hmm. once you start thinking about that, you're spending a little bit of time thinking about that, and then a little bit less time thinking about football and what you're actually doing right now. So it was a slow, for me, it was a slow degrading process up until the tenth year. Which is when I decided to call it quits.
And how's the body now?
You know, I went and had a full evaluation last year, and he made a bigger deal about my injuries and past injuries than I do, which, you know, kind of opened my eyes a little bit. I'm always like, I'm okay. You know, I can get this done. I have this to do. I have this to do, this to do. I ain't got time for pain. I ain't got time to be laying around. I got to do this. So, but, you know, him running through my chart all in one sitting, my 10-year chart all in one sitting, and doing all the x-rays and just checking your body from head to toe. This is for the NFL. And he's telling me what I have coming ahead, you know, with my knee or my hip or my ankle or my shoulder or my wrist or my neck, whatever, you know. And, you know, that took me back a little bit because I don't really think about that stuff. You know, it hurts, but I rotate my wrist. It don't hurt anymore. I'm fine until, you know, 15 minutes late. But I can't complain, man. Like, I had a lot of injuries and I had a lot of surgeries, but I never had, like, a major ACL, mm-hmm. you know what I'm saying? Or a broken leg or a broken arm or, you know, clavicle, rotator cuff. I had a rotator cuff in high school, but I was past it by the time I got to Kansas State. But, you know, I never had those. I just had a lot of medium injuries, I guess you would say.
Yeah.
Nothing like super major. So, you know, to play that long, you know, including the 10 years, 5 years at Kansas State, and then I was playing football since I was 8 before that. That's a long time to come out the way I came out. I'm blessed, and I'm thankful that, you know, I have what I have. I can still walk. I can still jog a bit, you know. Up until COVID started, I was in basketball leagues. I was still playing. So, you know, I can't complain, man. Like, I don't feel great, but I don't feel like shit either.
Yeah. I get that. It's amazing how the standard kind of goes. I don't feel like shit. That's good. That's good.
Yeah.
One more thing that I'm interested in, going from New Orleans to Philly seems like, you know, football's a business. I get that. But that is such a cultural change. Those two cities are so different, aren't they? Or are they not?
I would agree with that. I would agree with that. So that change pales in comparison between where I'm from and Manhattan, Kansas.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
And then Manhattan, Kansas to New Orleans. So New Orleans and Philly is like, eh. You know, it's like, eh, it's another city. You know, but New Orleans, even now, as an adult, like, that was the first major city that I lived in. Man, it's not even major. I can't even call it a major city, but the first city I lived in where I was an adult and I was not from there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Kansas, I was in school. Cool. Move to New Orleans, you're on your own. You got to figure everything out. Everything's not structured for you. And just being more engrossed with a city of people. And New Orleans is like its own country, man. It's not even like the languages. They speak different.
Yeah.
They have their own language. I don't know if you guys know that. Yeah, they, like, we were in the swamp in training camp, and I would go to a store and pick some stuff up, and the two guys would be behind the counter talking. I have no idea what they're saying.
Incredible.
No idea what they're saying. You know, the food is different. The music is different. The buildings are different. The people are different. The traditions and the culture are different. You know, they have parades for no reason down there. And they all dress like Indians. They're black people dressed like Indians. Why are we dressed like Indians today?
Yeah.
You know, but, you know, over time, you figure out the culture and where it comes from, where it started, where it originated. That is a French colony back in the day, and everything kind of transitioned. That's why you have all the E-A-U-X's rather than the O's. And you start to learn all this stuff. Like, oh, that's cool, man. Cool. I like this. But definitely, man, a different city for a lot of different reasons, good and bad. So I know when I was there, it was one of the crime capitals and murder capitals of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have, like, downtown is surrounded by the wards. You know, so, I mean, you don't know where you're going. And you can go the wrong way. You end up somewhere you don't need to mm-hmm. be. So it's one of those things. But New Orleans, I would say, is different from any city. Like, it would be a culture shock for anybody to come from any city and go to New Orleans, just like it would be for somebody from New Orleans to go to any other city, which happened for Katrina.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people had to leave and never came back home. And they ended up in Atlanta and Houston and Dallas and San Antonio. And some people were in Idaho and Iowa, and first time out of the city, first time knowing life outside of New Orleans and actually seeing people living better lives, like that look like them, that live better lives than they were able to live in New Orleans with no more skill set than they had. You know, like, people moved to Atlanta, saw all these, like, Atlanta's the black capital of the world right now. And those guys out there living great. You know, big houses, a lot of land, whatever car you want, not doing anything special, just working. And people from New Orleans see that, like, why couldn't we do that? So they stay there and they figure it out. Now they have their own house and their own land, and they don't never come back to New Orleans. So, it's just it's a different city. When I was in New Orleans, I had my foundation, and I was taking kids to this place called Celebration Station. It was like a playground, like amusement park kind of thing, arcade games and go kart and mini golf and all that kind of stuff. And it was literally like a 15-minute ride from the ward to the Celebration Station. And when I was picking these kids up, and their parents were talking like, you're taking our kids out of town. I'm like, what? It's 15, you've never been right there? No, never been there.
Crazy.
Like, wow. So, yeah.
Now, New Orleans is a fun
time, though.
Place.
I love New Orleans. I love New Orleans.
That culture is so cool. I saw this kind of spinning off into a weird place, but I saw this really cool documentary about the birth of the blues, and mm-hmm. that you can draw the line of the blues back to Native American roots. And one of the big focal points of that, of course, is New Orleans, where the escaped slaves and the Native Americans intermingled so much, and that's why that culture is there with everyone dressed up as Indians, because they have Indian heritage. It's absolutely incredible, and it's not something I really had ever thought about, the importance of that and how it led to the blues, and it was incredible. It was just a really eye-opening experience, because they had some Native American singers doing traditional music. It was a tribe I didn't know. It was from the South, and it was, as soon as they start singing, you go, this is the blues. I mean, this is incredible how our culture has cross-pollinated, so to speak. But
New Orleans has the best music, best musicians, and the best food.
And I got to tell you, I've traveled a lot of places, and this was pre-Katrina, but I had never been felt more welcomed than that's down in New Orleans.
Yeah.
It was amazing. Of course, I also didn't wander too far. I loved New Orleans. I'd love to go back. I just haven't been back. And one of the things I've always wanted to kind of bring this thing full circle is I always wanted to see K-State fans at the Sugar Bowl, because I think that would be 25,000 K-State fans in New Orleans would be one of the most crazy cultural collisions I could think of.
I think that would be the calmest Bourbon Street has ever been. That would be my prediction. Like, they would get there and they would sightsee, but there would be like no drinking. Everybody be home by 7.
Oh, I don't know, man. I don't know. they
might. You got better insight on the fan culture than I do.
They might have a lot of fun in New Orleans.
Yeah, but the comparison between regular Bourbon crowd and Kansas State Ema crowd, I think it would be drastic.
Yeah, it'd be crazy. Darren, I appreciate it, man. I hope you're doing well, and Tampa's a cool place. I love going down there. I've got some friends in Sarasota, and it's just a great part. I was born in West Palm. I didn't grow up there, but I've got a real affection for the state of Florida, and I'm glad you're doing well.
Yeah, thank you, man. Thank you. Good talking to you, Darren.
Yeah, good talking to you. And if you hear from Niall Wyron, let me know.
I saw Niall. I saw Niall twice when I was here. He lives here locally.
Oh, really?
And the first time I saw him was at a charity function. It was at a skeet shooting range, and he was there. I had no idea he was going to be there. And then the other time I saw him, he was still playing with the Storm. That was a long, long, long time ago. Oh, but I didn't really get a chance to talk to him much. You know, he didn't seem too interested. So I don't know. He had a lot going on. I know his wife passed away a while ago during birth. And I have no idea where he is now, though. Hmm.
I just assumed he was at witness protection.
Maybe.
Thank you, my friend.
Love him to death, though.
Yeah, he's a good dude. Thank you. Yeah. Great to talk to you. Thanks, Darren.
All right. Thanks, Tim.
Bye. Bye. You know, I've learned through doing these podcasts, these conversations, never prejudge how long a discussion's going to be. And what I mean by that is, I thought this would be like a 30, 40 minute discussion in and out. Darren's not a big talker. And honestly, I didn't have as much background on him as I did other guys, but that went really well. I just really enjoyed that. How did I not know Darren Howard was a DJ in college? I feel like I absolutely failed everyone by not knowing that detail back in 98 when the football team was so good that he was a DJ. It's beautiful. It's really cool to see how it kind of carried on now into his professional life post-football. Well, that'll do it for another edition of The Life of Fitz. I got some great guests I'm working on here for the coming weeks, and we're going to steer off into some other areas as we focus on my life outside of K-State sports, but I'll take you along for the ride. I hope you enjoy it. And remember, guys, do it for Matt Miller. Go get your PSA scored. Let's get everyone that listens to this that's 45 and older to have their score. Do that for me. Do that for Matt. Because the PSA score, a simple blood test, is the best way for the early diagnosis of prostate cancer. And if you catch it early, you're going to win the battle. Take care, everyone. I'll talk to you real soon.
CBS Wednesday.
We have so many cool, diverse people from different backgrounds, different beliefs, different upbringings, and it just keeps growing.
I'm a citizen of the United States.
I'm a hustler.
I'm a big Taylor Swift fan.
I'm the queen of the tribe. I'm a
survivor. I am playing whatever role I gotta play.
I'm gonna play this game full speed.
I ain't going down like no punk.
A new Survivor, Wednesday on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.